all across America and around the world. This is Veterans Radio.
This is Veterans Radio.
And now, your host for today's program, Bob Gould.
And good evening, good afternoon, good day, no matter where you are in the world. You're listening to Veterans Radio right here on Talk Radio 1600 WAAM, coming to you from the Garden Spot of the Midwest, the Garden Spot of Michigan, of course, Ann Arbor. And here we are once again at Veterans Radio. My partner Dale Thronberry is on leave right now. Dale, if you're listening in, have a great afternoon and a great tomorrow and all that other stuff. He'll be back next week. In fact, next week, folks, is going to be our Gifts for Veterans, our annual Gifts for Veterans. You're going to want to tune in for that. Of course, you want to tune in for all the programs, but the one for Gifts for Veterans, you know, I don't know what to get for my dad. He's a veteran. Well, you know, we got books. We just have a ton of stuff. In fact, one of the things that we have is going to be my first guest today, and with me right now is John Ryder. He is the executive director of the Michigan Military and Space Heroes Museum, and a big Veterans Radio welcome to John Ryder. John?
Thank you, Bob. How are you doing this evening?
I'm doing great, and you're coming nice and clear.
Wonderful.
No, it's really good to have everything working so well. Isn't that right, Derek? Yes, he's shaking his head. There we are. John, welcome to Veterans Radio. You are the curator. You're the executive director, and you spend your time serving and honoring those who have served in the armed forces. Tell us a little bit about the Michigan Military and Space Heroes Museum.
So the Michigan Military and Space Heroes Museum was started when a 13-year-old boy was walking up and down the alleyways of Detroit, and he decided to go through the trash and the things that were being thrown out by moms as guys were coming home for World War II. That man, Stan Bozich, was also a Korean War veteran, a Navy veteran, and he started the museum here over 35 years ago up here in Frankenmuth.
Now, where's Frankenmuth?
Frankenmuth is a great tourist destination. It's the number one tourist destination in the state. And he thought, well, you know what, if he wanted to attract people, that this would be a good place.
Well, if I can say something, I'm saying that because a lot of folks aren't from Michigan and they may be traveling through during the holidays. But Frankenmuth, they had a beer brewery there at Frankenmuth Beer, right? John,
absolutely.
I got that, and they have Bronner's Christmas, 365 days a year, Bronner's, and of course, the world-famous chicken dinners at Frankenmuth, and then we now have the Michigan, I'm going to get this right, Michigan Military and Space Heroes Museum. Now, today's program is going to be about Korea, John, and you have one portion of your museum is to honor the Medal of Honor recipients. Why don't you tell us about those that were in the Korean War and received the Medal of Honor?
Absolutely. So at the museum, one of the few things that a lot of people from Michigan don't realize is that here at the Michigan's Military and Space Heroes Museum in Frankenmuth, we have the largest collection of Medals of Honor anywhere in the country. We've got 29 medals, and featuring in with those, we have Dwayne Dewey and Bob Simonek, who were both Marines during the Korean War. And then we also have Bill Charette, who was alongside the Marines. He was a Navy corpsman, a medic for those guys.
One thing I do want to say, John, and folks, I have been to the museum. When I think museum, I think dusty and dirt and cobwebs and all. No. Your displays are, they jump out. They're like frozen photographs, all your displays, but they're so well, just tell us a little bit about that. How do you maintain that?
Sure. So the displays that we have are stories of each servicemen and women that we've got here, from the governors of the state of Michigan right on through from the Spanish-American War until the current war on terror. And we also have astronauts from the state of Michigan. But we look to honor, respect, and remember these men and women by telling their stories in of their service and in that snapshot, that portion of their life. Like Dwayne Dewey, the first Korean vet that I mentioned, Dwayne, a great guy. He is he was a Marine with the 5th Marines over in Korea, and he left his foxhole to go get some ammunition, and he was returning to his position, and he had a grenade roll under his foot, and it went off. And then he had a corpsman come over and was working on him, and the corpsman, he pulled the corpsman down onto him and said, "Doc, there's another grenade here." He put it under his body, and he pulled the corpsman close. He said, "Doc, I've got it in my hip pocket." And instead of trying to throw that grenade away because he didn't think he'd be able to get it outside of his men. And so we've got his story here in the museum, just an amazing hero there. And then Bob Simonek also, who took a grenade for his buddies in the foxhole with him, and just really
they gave up their lives.
Amazing stories of heroism.
And again, I want to now. This is for the whole family. Is that right? You have plenty of bathrooms and things there. I mean, is this something the whole family can go to the Michigan Military and Space Heroes Museum?
Yes, absolutely. The displays are for middle school on up. Going to be more geared towards them, but for the younger visitors, we do have things to keep them interested and engaged. And the staff here is very good at engaging the younger individuals also, so that the older visitors can spend time absorbing everything that's here.
You know what and as I said, the way it's displayed, folks, is it just jumps right out at you, all the displays, and they also have what was that ship that you have, that 10-foot, 12-foot model ship?
Yes, the USS Missouri. So that's probably about 12 foot. Absolutely. It's an Iowa-class battleship, and we also have the USS Iowa here as well, on the same scale. They were both hand-built by a gentleman that built them in his basement, and he had to disassemble them to bring them into the museum. They're that large.
Now, you say military and space heroes. Very quickly, tell us about some space heroes.
So we've got Colonel Jack Lausma, who was sitting at Capsule Communications during the Apollo 13 mission, and he was the guy who, when they said, "Houston, we have a problem," they were talking to Jack. Jack also flew in on the Apollo mission up to Skylab, and he was also on STS-3, which was the third space shuttle mission ever. Just have a bunch of amazing stories. We've got Al Warden, who went up to the moon, but not to the surface of the moon. He piloted the command module, and they allowed him to take the first Earth out of Earth orbit spacewalk as he was orbiting the moon also. So just a lot of amazing history from that period of time also.
Well, you folks have certainly put something together that I recommend all of our listeners at some point come on out to Frankenmuth, Michigan, which is about, 40 miles, 60 miles from Detroit, dead north?
Yeah, it's a,
like that.
It's a maybe an hour drive from the northern suburbs.
Yeah,
so.
Give or take a few here, and they have 8 galleries, and that includes the World War I polar bears, World War II in Korea, Vietnam, Gulf War, War on Terror. Woo! Space Pioneers Michigan. Oh, and I see here, is that the actual size of the Mercury capsule?
So that's one-third scale.
Okay.
That we have here is that we've got a one-third scale size model of the capsule that actual General McDivitt, when he retired, General McDivitt, but he was piloting that when Ed White stepped out and took the very first spacewalk ever.
Yeah, one other thing, folks, that caught my attention when you folks who are down here in Farmington at the 101st luncheon, they have World War II parachute wings, the real things, man. Not many were honored to be able to wear those, and they really, really, really are silver. They're beautiful. Where did you get those?
So everything that's at the museum has been donated by a veteran and or his family, or her family, and so everything that we have is a donation from the individuals that wore them themselves or their family members. And you know, I know you mentioned you were focusing on Korea. Right now in our Crane Gallery, we've got a MASH nurse out. We've got Corporal Lutz from Bay City, who was in the Chosen Reservoir. We've got female Lieutenant Colonel Hunt, who was a Lieutenant Colonel at Selfridge Air Force Base. Got Lieutenant Colonel Cecil Foster, who was the Michigan's top ace during Korea, and it goes on and on. We've got so many amazing stories.
All right, folks, I want to invite every one of our listeners to come to the Michigan Military and Space Heroes Museum. It's in Frankenmuth, Michigan, and you can go to Michigan's, it's not apostrophe S, just Michigan'sMilitaryMuseum.com. That's Michigan'sMilitaryMuseum.com. They're open 7 days a week. You've got about 30 seconds. John, what would you like to say real quick?
Well, I would like to thank all of our veterans for their service to the country, and I would also like to welcome all of them to come here, not only visit our museum, but also consider letting us tell the stories of your loved ones this holiday season and allowing us to capture what their service meant, not only to them, and what it means to us as Americans today.
Thank you very much, John Ryder, Executive Director of the Michigan Military and Space Heroes Museum. John will actually be with us next week during our Gifts for Veterans, and we'll tell you all about that next week. John, thank you very much.
You bet. Have a great day, Bob.
Okay, we're going to be right back with our Korean segment, Chosen, the Frozen Chosen Reservoir. Don't go away. You're listening to Veterans Radio right here on WAAM Talk Radio 1600. Yes, that's the Marine, the God of our fathers, and Navy and Marines. Mm-hmm. And that's going to kind of lead us into today's program, Dale. I've been wanting to do this one for a long time, and I've been collecting. We have three wonderful gentlemen, three Marines and an Army guy, but the Marines were there in Korea in 1950, and I have a historian who's been on our program many times, Colonel William C. Latham. He is, and I'm going to read this right there. Bill Latham is a writer, historian, course director, and he's with the United States Army Logistics University at Fort Lee, Virginia. He flew Chinook helicopters. Here we
go. The big
come.
Boys.
Yeah, the big boys. See, yeah, that's right. And, you know, I heard one of those taking off. God, the noise. Whoa. Wow, was that loud.
Plus, it blew down half the country.
Yes, he resides in Petersburg, Virginia. He's currently in Colorado. Took some time to give us a call. So, welcome, everybody. Let's give a big welcome to Colonel William Latham right on our program. Bill?
Good afternoon, Bob. How are you doing?
Oh, we're doing great. And also, I want to welcome, and they should be on right now, Fred Sozio. Fred.
Sir.
Ah, I got one Marine. The next guy, Paul.
Hello.
Yay. Oh, we're going to have a good time. We're not, and it was 64 years ago? 64 years ago. Nobody. Korea? I couldn't even spell it. But I happened to be giving a book report back in November of 1950, or I think it was December, and stumbled upon a Detroit News article. And again, it wasn't huge news back then, Korea. So I've had an early exposure to that. And I've always wanted to talk with, and I had wonderful experience with all the pre-interviews with the Marines that are going to be on our program today. Colonel Latham, his book, Cold Days in Hell, American POWs in Korea. By the way, folks, Christmas time is coming. You're going to want to Google that, Cold Days in Hell, American POWs in Korea, by Colonel William Latham, L-A-T-H-A-M. So he knows his Korea. Colonel, okay. Here we are. I think Korea's a proxy. Mao wants to spread communism. He knows he's going to buck the West. The West has nuclear weapons. Mao had just got through. By the way, Mao was one of our allies. And at the end of World War II, China, we were in lockstep with China. But all of a sudden, things change. And along comes Korea. I think it was a proxy between the East and the West. Tell us about that, Bill.
Well, thank you, Bob. Yes, Korea was a proxy for essentially a proxy for World War III. Quite frankly, budget cuts after World War II had reduced the conventional military capability of U.S. armed forces, and Washington had been sending signals directly or indirectly, unintentionally, suggesting that we would not lift a finger to defend Korea. We withdrew our troops in 1948. We just had a few advisors on the ground, a few hundred advisors working with the South Korean Army, and we did not equip the South Korean Army with heavy weapons. And so South Korea looked like it was ripe for the picking. North Korea, the North Korean leader, Kim Il-sung, persuaded Stalin to allow him to take his Soviet-equipped army south of the 38th parallel in what he assumed would be a rapid blitzkrieg victory over the South Korean forces. And President Truman, to his great credit, I think, decided that we would not stand for that and directed General MacArthur from Tokyo to assess the situation and make a recommendation. MacArthur said we needed ground troops, and ground troops we sent. And a combination of air and ground troops from Japan and from other countries, along with the South Koreans, managed to defeat the North Korean invasion, following which we decided, perhaps unwisely, to push north of the 38th parallel in an effort to reunite the Korean Peninsula under the rule of South Korea. And
well,
our
almost sounds revisionist as we look back on it, but it was Come Out of My House with Rosemary Clooney. It was Arthur Godfrey, and it's 1950. We're 5 years removed, not even 5 years removed from war, and all of a sudden this thing is coming. But then you said that we told the world that we're not going to intervene in Korea. So Mao must have thought that that was a green light, and it was his chance to expand communism. Although, I always wonder, and I want you to comment on Mao, it's not going to happen, Mao. And I mean, what, you're going to change the United States, we're going to go from a democracy to communism over your time? Come on, tell us about that, Bill. Was the guy a dreamer?
Well, He could have very easily conquered the Korean Peninsula and made it a puppet state for the Chinese, if Joseph Stalin had kept his promise. Stalin promised Mao that if Mao sent his army across the Yalu River to save the North Koreans, who were on the brink of defeat in October of 1950, Stalin promised that he would provide air support for Chinese forces if they intervened in North Korea.
Wow. Boy, does that sound
like... If Stalin had kept his promise, we would have been in terrible shape. And even without that air support, UN forces and South Korean forces were driven back below the 37th parallel, well below the South Korean capital of Seoul. And at one point in December, MacArthur was seriously considering a total withdrawal from the Korean Peninsula.
Whoa. Let's get to Fred Soscio, who was a cook in the Marines, 1st Marine Division, over there in Korea, and was in North Korea when all this was going on. Fred, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Yes.
Are you there?
I'm here.
Oh, I'm here. Yeah. Oh, you're from Texas, right? So,
not quite.
And Fred and I have had many, many discussions about this. How long were you in the Army when all this, when June 1950 hit? Where were you?
June of 1950?
That's right, when all this started.
We were getting ready to go up to California, because Chesty reformed the 1st Marine Division. And then from there we went to Kobe, Japan. And then MacArthur came out with that landing at Incheon, where we split them in half. And we landed at Incheon, and from there we advanced up to Seoul and so on.
And you were cooking, right?
Not all the time.
Oh, what else did you do?
I was dodging bullets.
Every Marine is a rifleman first.
Right. And Paul from Flint, Michigan. Paul, welcome to Veterans Radio. How are you today?
Pretty good.
Good. And where were you in June 1950?
I was in Camp Lejeune in the 2nd Marine Division when the war started.
And how long had you been in?
I'd been in 3 years then, but counting the Navy, I was 5 years. And I had 5 years of service in 1950.
And here's this thing comes up, Paul, called Korea. What did you think about? What did you guys in your outfit think about at that moment?
Well, we just got back from the Mediterranean in January, and I never heard of the place myself. And we were waiting for in June, we were waiting for our discharge in September. I was supposed to be discharged on the 14th of September, 1950. My enlistment would be up.
Well, that took care of that.
This invasion.
When were you on a ship or an airplane headed to Korea?
Well, we left Camp Lejeune, went to San Diego, and got aboard a ship and went from San Diego to Kobe, Japan, getting ready for the invasion of Incheon. Then from Kobe, we got aboard the landing craft, and we went to Incheon, made the landing.
You were landed at Incheon, right?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Whoa. How about you, Fred? Where were you for Incheon?
We landed in Incheon also.
And you were right there?
We took off from Kobe on LSTs in advance up to Incheon. And we made the landing at, I don't know, 4:30 or 5 o'clock at night, I think it was September 15th.
Yeah.
Ask the colonel if he knows that date.
That's a fact. Okay. They went in right at dusk, right before it got dark.
That's right. I'll never forget that date.
And how... How did you feel at that moment, Fred?
Well, I don't know. You know, you're a little scared, and that, like everybody else.
And
we didn't have too much resistance at all. I was surprised.
That's what I thought, and the things that I've read, that there wasn't there right at the beginning. And why was that? Because the North Koreans had pulled back? Is that it?
I know. I just think we got them. Personally, I think we caught him by surprise myself.
Well, I'm not a big fan of MacArthur, but that certainly impressed me. And how about that, Colonel? When he made these plans for Inchon, how was that accepted at the time?
Omar Bradley, who was the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, said that Inchon was the absolute worst beach in the world to conduct an amphibious landing on.
That's right.
But it worked, partly because the Chinese and the Soviets told Kim Il-sung that he ought to mine the harbor, and Kim Il-sung dismissed their concerns until it was too late. There were mines en route from the Soviet Union to Seoul for emplacement at Incheon. They didn't get there in time. The Marines got there first.
And, boy, that must really have been something. And, Paul, were you in a LST?
I was on an LST with the 1st Marines waiting to go into Incheon. And we went to, it was like Fred said, it was about 4 or 5 o'clock at night. It was raining, Derek. And there wasn't much resistance at Incheon. We went right through Incheon.
Oh, but it was raining. And did you have anything to eat?
Just sea rations that we carry with us.
I mean, you know, I think about those things.
I'm always hungry, that's
right. Yeah, well, an Army travels on its stomach. Marines, I'm sure, do too, travel on their stomach. And okay, it's raining, and now you guys are going ashore. And, all right, you go ashore. You didn't put up a tent. What did you do that evening, Paul?
Well, we went ashore, and I found my company. I had my Jeep and trailer. I found my company, and we started moving. We moved through Incheon very fast. And I just went along with what I was supposed to do. I was a driver for the regimental operations officer. And I drove my lieutenant constantly, and we went right through Incheon. We didn't have any tentage, and we carried sea rations. We lived out on the ground first, till after the conquest of Seoul. We never had tentage or nothing till after that. We just dug in at night, jumped off in the morning, steady, until we got the... We took care of all the towns between Incheon and Seoul, and then we fought for Seoul for quite a while, and then that was it.
Now, when you went on shore, what did you carry with you? Did you have a 45 or a M1?
I had an M1.
And were you qualified?
Oh, yeah. I was on the rifle range. It must be I could shoot straight.
And so here you are. When did the? I mean, you are a cook, and I mean, I don't mean that disparagingly. I mean, gee, that's a very, very important position. And if you were right there with Chesty Puller, wasn't that correct? Or
yeah.
Close? Yeah.
Yeah.
And what was he
doing?
I was
on the same LST with Chesty.
And what was he doing all this time?
Well, I don't know if Paul remembers, but what our LST on was capsized, and everybody was sleeping on tables, and everybody landed on the deck except him. He slept like a baby. He didn't even wake up.
Right, but he was in control. It's just that other things were happening that he just didn't have to direct. Is that correct?
When he woke up in the morning, he says, when is this all going to start? And then the destroyers came up close, and they really softened up the beach before we went in.
Now, were you there before the tide went out, Fred?
No, we had to wait till the tide got in. We waited for the tide to get high.
Whoa, boy, we're at the halfway point already. Yeah. Okay, how much time we got, 30 seconds? What, this is it? Oh, okay, Fred, Paul, we'll be right back. Veterans Radio, Dale, and Bill Latham. Don't go away, man. You're going to want to hear all this. Yeah, here we are. Bob Gould, as you know, that's been pre-recorded last year and last December. And I just love those guys. Boy, when they asked them, what were you doing? Dodging bullets. I mean, if that's not a great response, woo, I love it. Okay, we're talking about the Korean War, and during the Korean War, there were, in 1950, 519,000 in the Army, and 330,000 in the Navy, 67,000 in the Marine Corps and the Air Force. Whoa, 354,000. We had quite a few. Total Americans with actual service in Korea, 1,500,000. We'll be right back with Korea, Frozen Chosen, right after this very important message. That's, I believe, the Semper Fidelis March, or the Marine March. Right. We were talking to a couple of Marines, Fred Sozio and Paul Fortino, Flint, Michigan. And they're both from the 1st Marine Division. We're talking about, and by the way, that guy that defected to North Korea.
Mm-hmm. Let him stay there. He'll be very happy, I'm sure.
Oh, I'm sure he's going to be. Yeah, welcome to the gulag. They'll take care of him. How about that, Colonel? I mean, is this guy right or what? Let me write my head.
I was just trying to find out how you say good luck with all that in Korean, but
yeah.
maybe one of your other listeners can tell you. Yeah, good luck to him.
Okay, we're back to Incheon. Incheon's over. Chesty Puller, they're all aboard. They're aboard, and they're on their that's landing ship troops. And was that the one with the
landing ship
transport.
Tank?
Oh, not transport.
Yeah.
Oh, is that the one with the two stairways on?
That's on the side, and it's got a big flap that comes down onto the beach.
Paul, were you in your Jeep when you landed at Incheon?
Yeah, I was up on the weather deck on that LST. The next morning, he brought the LST up the shore and dropped that ramp. I drove down the ramp onto the beach. And there was a lot of activity going on. They were unloading supplies all over.
Oh, yeah. So, okay, now you guys, all right, you Marines, and we won't go into a whole lot because you're pushing north. You crossed the 38th parallel. Colonel Latham, what was that? Was that a slap in the face to Mao when they crossed the 38th parallel and kept going?
Well, the Chinese had sent us very clear warnings that they would intervene if UN forces crossed north of the 38th parallel. They were not too worried about South Korean troops, but they did not want to see MacArthur's UN forces crossing north of the 38th parallel. We ignored those warnings and went ahead and crossed on 8 October and managed to capture the capital of North Korea within less than 2 weeks, at which point most people thought the war was over. The Marines were waiting to land on the northeastern coast of North Korea near Hungnam, but the South Korean infantry divisions marching up the coast road on the east side of the peninsula had already reached past Hungnam and pushed further north. It really looked like, with UN forces spread across the peninsula heading towards the Yalu, that the war was over. And in fact, at his famous meeting with Truman at Midway Island, MacArthur actually discussed the possibility of transferring, the 2nd Infantry Division from Korea to Germany once the, operations in Korea were mopped up. And he really did think, MacArthur really did think we would be home by Christmas.
Fred, did you think that?
Yeah, we did.
You guys were saying, we're done. We're going to be going home. This is a piece of cake.
Yeah, we had our hopes up, but it didn't work out that way.
And, Paul, what did you think?
Well, we heard the rumors that they were going back to the States, and we were pretty happy about it. We just waited day by day to see what occurred, you know.
Okay, so you're moving. Was either one of you gentlemen at Hungnam? The one where they're at, when they had the second little invasion.
Right, the Marines landed at Wonsan. I misspoke.
Oh, okay, Wonsan. Where were you, Fred, when all that went on? Fred?
Cleaned out all the mines out.
You were clearing mines?
Not me, the Navy.
And you were cooking all this time. Did you have trouble catching up with the guys?
I was cooking on ship when I was on the ship. Helping the Navy guys, Navy cooks, because we were feeding the Marines and Navy.
And of course, provide.
We landed it, and once they cleared the harbor, there were tons of mines on the shore when we went in. Then we went in, and that's when we went north. We went north.
And you went all the way, and it's Thanksgiving. Now, let's cut right to Thanksgiving, November 1950. I've seen black and white film of this. You're having turkey, you're having dressing. And
I don't know. Ask Paul. He might know. I don't.
Paul,
I don't remember.
What did you have for Thanksgiving in 1950?
Well, I heard that they had turkey dinners, but I was on a recon with my lieutenant on the way to Costa Rica, and we never saw any turkey at all. But we heard a lot of rumors.
A lot of pictures.
Yeah, a lot of pictures. We just said sea rations. I was on the road all the time.
Okay.
We were reconning down on the road to Costa Rica.
Okay, all right, so now you're going north, and now it's Thanksgiving, and everybody's got smiles on their faces.
Yeah.
It happens to be the beginning of the coldest winter in Korea, and was it 100 or 150 years?
Yeah, quite a while, 40 years I used to hear. It was pretty bad.
Now, guys, Fred and Paul, were you guys dressed for it?
Yeah, they issued fur parkas and boots.
Oh, you got the Mickey Mouse boots?
Yeah, they weren't any good, but we got the Mickey Mouse boots and the fur parkas and the hoods and the gloves. They brought them up, and we were pretty well covered up with that stuff.
How about you, Fred? What did you have to move off the cold?
Well, I had the same outfit. We had long parkas and... Actually, Paul, they brought the parkas up and they shot them down from the air. They airdropped them down, the parkas.
And so you had, I know, the Mickey Mouse boots, folks, they were called that because they were white with felt liners, and the liners that you changed the liners to.
No, these weren't white. These were black.
Oh,
boots.
Okay.
They were called, we call them shoe packs.
Okay. And did they keep your feet warm?
Yeah, when you're walking during the day and at nighttime, you know, you go to sleep or something, and then your feet are kind of frosted up a little bit because you were sweating, you know, while you're walking and running around all day, and they didn't help out too good.
Okay, and
I mean, everybody's come back with frostbitten.
All right, now,
eating all that.
But now you're at the Chosin Reservoir, and there was talk about MacArthur wanted to, and I'll get with Bill real quick. MacArthur wanted to go to Manchuria. He wanted to drop the atomic bomb. Tell us about that.
MacArthur panicked. He failed to anticipate the massive Chinese counterattack on both sides of the peninsula. On the west side, several hundred thousand Chinese forces pushed the Eighth Army back. And the Eighth Army and our South Korean allies retreated more than 100 miles in less than 2 weeks, all the way back down below the 38th parallel, because the Chinese were able to put so many more troops on the ground than we had. We were totally outnumbered. That was less the situation around the Chosin Reservoir. The Chinese still had a 2-to-1 advantage, but the Chinese troops at the Chosin Reservoir were as much less well equipped than the Marines or the Army units to cope with the cold weather. They had almost no medical support. They had no medical evacuation capability, and they had no heavy artillery. Mao had pushed those forces into eastern North Korea in a hurry because he panicked and thought that UN forces were going to reach the Yalu in strength before he could get his forces into blocking position.
Okay, folks, this is we're on the brink of World War III. Isn't that right, Bill?
Oh, definitely.
And the point of the spear was you, Fred.
Yes.
Yeah, and you and Paul and all of your comrades, right? You guys were right there at the tip of the spear. How far were you from the border?
I think it was about 17 miles. Yeah, 17 miles.
You were certainly learning your sushi at that point. and were you cooking? No.
No,
okay, so you were a rifleman.
We didn't have none of those outdoor ovens or anything up there.
Okay, so you didn't have nothing. When did you first see your first Chinese?
We took in eight Chinese, and they, like the colonel said, they went. They had all these like jackets on, quilted jackets they had on, and there's a couple of them had ice around his foot. About, oh man,
oh.
It was about 6 inches all around. Of he couldn't even walk, the poor bugger. But we're gonna brought him in and, you know, give him a cigarette and stuff like that.
And Paul, what where were you when you saw your first Chinese?
I was on a recon on the way to Coterie, and there was a Chinese prisoner on the side of the road, and his rifle was frozen into his hand, and his feet were just two bloody clumps. He was completely, I don't know how long he lasted. He was pretty bad.
Okay, but it was it just their vast numbers? Were you seeing these as you guys were, and what they, I'm trying to think of who the general, I don't think it was Puller, who said, we're not withdrawing, we're attacking to the rear. Who was that?
That was General O.P. Smith.
O.P. Smith,
commander.
Yeah.
Howland Smith, right?
He was strung out from Corey to 10 miles to Hagaroo, where the 5th Marines, and 10 miles north of them at Udamney was the 7th Regiment. They caught the brunt of it. They were ready to, they were at the farthest point north. We were all, the whole division was strung out on the road for miles.
And
that's right.
They attacked every point. They attacked at Udamney, Hagaroo, and Coterie. I was at Coterie. We tried to leave once on a patrol. We were driven back right away.
Well, okay, you're in a sense you're surrounded. You can't go forward anymore. You're now attacking to the rear, and you have Chinese to your left, to your right on the ridges. And were you traveling at night?
We traveled day and night. After, see, the 7th Marines made their way to the 5th Marines at Hagaroo. Then they fought their way from Hagaroo to Coterie, where we were located, and they all left. We were the last ones to leave Coterie.
Oh.
See, the 1st Marines was the last ones to leave Coterie. They, and then, of course, it was a fighting off and on the road down to the coast. And we were the last ones in line. And we drove us very slowly, steady, and there was a frequent stop while the Chinese would come down and attack the cowboys. There'd be a lot of fighting and all that. When they got them cleared, well, we started moving again. It took a couple of days.
Now, folks, we were attacking to the rear. We're moving now, and where were they going, Bill?
Well, the Marines and the Army units attached to the 1st Marine Division were trying to get down from the reservoir, which was on a high mountain plateau, all the way down this narrow trail past Coterie, over the Funchilin Pass down to Hung Nam, where the UN forces had a secure perimeter. And the last major battle of that breakout was fought at Funchilin Pass, where the Chinese dug in, blew the bridge, and fought nearly to the last man. And in fact, when the Marines finally captured the key Chinese positions, they found Chinese infantry frozen to death in their foxholes. The Air Force gets some credit here. The Air Force flew in 8 sections of air-droppable bridges, and 4 of those sections survived the drop. And Army and Marine units managed to assemble those bridge sections into a bridge across the Funchilin Pass, and that enabled the entire column of 30,000 Marines and soldiers to retreat across that pass and get down to the port of Hung Nam,
and to be rescued. Now, in your research, when they dropped, what kind of airplane carried those bridges? I mean,
nine box cars,
and that's what I jumped out of.
There you go,
C-119s.
I wonder if Fred and Paul remember going across that bridge, as I've read that there was just an inch or two on either side of the bridge.
How about it, Fred?
He's right on.
And well, yeah, and so there you didn't.
We couldn't move unless that bridge was put together. And like he said, the C-19s were 119s dropped all the bridges, and they.
That was a heck of an airplane,
put it all together.
It was called the Flying Boxcar, and that was my first 6 jumps. After that, they retired it, and I had the honor of parachuting from a C-119. So, okay, We're just about now at our third break, and Paul, I want to thank you. We're going to go with, we've got another guest to come on for the last 10 minutes. So, Paul, you're going to come back on our program again. Is that right?
Yep.
And we want to thank, we want to thank you for being our guest today. Fred, hang in there. Bill, hang in there. We'll be right back. You're listening to Veterans Radio. Don't you dare go away. And Brad, you're listening to Veterans Radio replay of a prior program in December of 2014. It's going to be on Korea and the Chosen Reservoirs. Folks, we'll be right back after this very important message. Ah, yeah, nice quick break. We're back with Colonel Bill Latham and Fred Sozio. Fred's a Marine from the Forgotten War, but he didn't forget it. And the Korean War, he was a rifleman and a cook over there with the 1st Marine Division. And I have on the phone now, on the line with me, is Roland Dedron. Roland, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Yes, Roland.
Yeah, there we go. Roland, you were with the 1st Marine Division, 7th Marines, right?
Yes, I was.
And you were a bulldozer operator, is that correct?
Well, that's because I was, my MOS was amphibious tractors. But when we got to Wonsan, and then up to Ham Hung, and then to Hong Nam, they switched the platoon. I was in the 4th Platoon Amtraks, and he put us attached to some Marines, motor transport, and we ended up driving bulldozers up. Because you see, Amtrak has scoops on them tracks and would ruin all the roads, ruin all the roads. But bulldozers had a flat track, and that's why they used us for trailers to haul ammunition and supplies up to the line or the coterie, if you might add.
Fred, I know you wanted to say something about the Navy and Marine pilots. Go ahead.
Well, they deserve a lot of credit. I mean, Rowley will tell you how they came down so low and just scraped those hills where the Chinese were, and, you know, and they did a great job.
And you guys watched this, right?
Yeah. And we even watched the Chinese come out of their foxholes and heat up their hands when they napalm was dropped.
And didn't you tell me that they were literally warming up after the napalm was dropped, wasn't that?
Yeah, after they came down. They probably didn't get hit with it, but they got out of their holes and went over, and they were warming their hands up.
With napalm.
Yeah.
Dale, do you have something?
No, I'm just sitting here fascinated about how you guys survived all this. The idea of the pilots, you know, going so low level when you've got hundreds of thousands of Chinese trying to take pot shots at them, it's amazing that they didn't get hit more often.
No, that's right.
And Roland, when we were talking the other day, you said that that you were doing a lot of the march in the other direction with lights out, blackout, right? Is that correct?
With, what did you say, blackout?
Yeah, when they you were telling me at night when you were moving the column that you had to go on. Tell us about blackout.
Well, we tried to march at night as best we could. Because the Chinese really couldn't follow us like they wanted to. But we really used to travel a lot during the day and had the 5th and the 1st Marines and the 11th Marines on our flanks to come out of there with bulldozers and trucks and all the wounded. The guys were frozen solid. And everybody thought they were dead. And we go back to Hong Nam. These guys survived the cold. But very rarely at night, sometimes they'd have a firefight at night, but not as often as everybody wants to believe.
So, Fred, what did you do at night? Okay, you weren't moving. Were you? When did you guys sleep?
Well, we slept in you could sleep in your sleeping bag, if you're the best place you could sleep. I mean, you know.
And
we weren't in a hotel room.
No. and I know that there was an airfield there. Tell us about the airfield, Bill.
Well, the airfield was supposed to be 5,000 feet long. That's how long it was designed to be. It didn't get finished, but it was long enough, just barely, for Air Force and Navy planes to come in and out of there, ferrying cargo, weapons, supplies, food, and this is very important, replacement Marines. And just as importantly, those cargo aircraft were able to evacuate thousands of wounded Marines, both those wounded by enemy action, and there were quite a few cold weather injuries among both the Marines and especially the Army units that got wiped out on the east side of the Chosin Reservoir from the 31st and 32nd Regiment. The survivors withdrew into the Marine lines around Hagaru and assisted in the breakout, but a lot of them were in terrible shape, as were quite a few Marines, and fortunately we had the cargo capability to fly those guys out of there, largely because General Smith insisted on building that airfield, which of course slowed things down and probably was the key factor in enabling the First Marine Division to survive that battle.
Bill, this is Dale. I'd question about the cold weather. We heard, I think it was Fred mentioned it earlier on, that you know many of these men were basically frozen solid, but because of that, they were able to survive. Could you explain that a little bit to our audience?
That's exactly right. The extreme cold, and it got down to temperatures around 35 degrees below zero at night. That extreme cold slowed down the blood flow and prevented a lot of Marines and a lot of soldiers from bleeding to death. The Chinese, on the other hand, were not allowed to light any warming fires. They had almost no shelter from the cold weather, and their clothes, they had padded quilted uniforms, but their footgear was awful. They were basically wearing canvas tennis shoes. And not only were they poorly clothed, but they also ran out of ammunition and food. They didn't bring enough of either, and they didn't have any effective supply lines. And so one of the reasons, as Raleigh mentioned, that Chinese resistance petered out pretty quickly on the withdrawal down the hill was that they were out of ammunition, they were out of food, and they were running out of men.
All right, folks, let's get to this because we've got about 5 minutes. Here we go. And I'm looking at his picture. This general, and he's got a whole chest full of fruit salad. That's a bunch of ribbons, folks, and he deserves it. Chesty Puller, and I'm going to quote him. "We've been looking for the enemy for some time now. We finally found them. We're surrounded. That simplifies our problem of getting to these people and killing them." Tell us about that, Fred.
Well, he just says we could shoot in any direction, you know, and that's his quote.
And you knew him, and tell us about the man.
He was just a great, great guy. And if you saw him, you think he was an ugly guy, you know, because he had that bulldog face, like, you know. But he was just a kind-hearted guy, and he used to go around and tell guys to make sure they write to their moms, or else that he'd say, "Now you write to your mother. That's an order," he used to say.
How about it, Raleigh?
He was a Marine, that guy. I can recall at Cordery when he came down in a Jeep, and there were three guys left at the Hagaruri at the foot of the reservoir. And he said, when he found that out, he told his driver, "Turn this thing around, let's go back." He said, Colonel, he said, there's a Chinese coming in on us. He said, "Turn the Jeep around and go back." He went back about 7 or 8 miles up there, and son of a gun, he came by here with those three guys. Went back in a Jeep, frozen solid, but he came out with them. He was one tremendous, tremendous individual. And I got his poster at home. I salute him every night at night. I say, "Good night, Chesty, wherever you are."
Who knew about John Ford? Which one of you guys knew about John Ford?
Not me.
The director. Okay, I have a note on here. John Ford. Apparently he was in Korea.
Ford was back in a movie out there.
Yeah, yeah. Were you the one to tell me about...
He wasn't too friendly.
Oh, okay. Well, here's to John.
So he used to get letters from Maureen O'Hara and Ski, the mail clerk.
What was his name?
We call him Ski. I forgot his name.
Okay.
And he was the mail clerk, and he'd go around, you know, giving you, when you get some mail, he'd go around delivering the mail.
Ah, yes. Okay. We come to the close of another Veterans Radio program. Be sure to be with us next week. We want to thank all the folks that were on the program last year and contributed to today's recording. This is Bob Gould. We want to thank our sponsors, The Life Chest, Legal Help for Veterans, XPO Logistics. Until next week, you are dismissed.